Perhaps we'll never know the answer to why the anthem of so many bar mitzvahs in the 80s was the Village People's YMCA. But this is the kind of phenomenon that's explored in the new book Bar Mitzvah Disco. It's all about bar mitzvahs from the late 70s to the early 90s, and it features many photos from bar mitzvah albums of the era. The authors had their bar mitzvahs in this period, and they described some of the parties as two parts Fantasy Island, one part Vegas. The bar and bat mitzvah are Jewish ceremonies that celebrate a young person's passage into adulthood at the age of 13. What fascinates the authors are the parties that follow the religious ceremony, particularly the extravagant catered affairs that became popular in the suburbs. My guests are Roger Bennett, Jules Schell, and Nick Kroll. Kroll is a comic and has been a contributing writer to Chappelle's Show. Bennett and Schell are part of the Reboot Network, a company trying to explore Jewish identity through music, film, discussions, and a new quarterly journal called Guilt and Pleasure. What are some of the things that you think make the 80s bar mitzvah unique and distinct from bar mitzvahs of every other decade?
It really became the apex of when bar mitzvahs began to change to the sort of a me generation vibe, where lots more money was being spent. Themes started to pop up, and the themes to us represent what is again a look at pop culture. So you had people with California Raisins costumes on running around, and you know, Van Halen cakes, and with the Police Synchronicity album below it. I mean, just sort of these bizarre manifestations together that really speak to us about what American culture was in the 80s.
And I think also the reality is that the 70s and the 80s, which is a time the book really spans, is a time when bar and bat mitzvahs stopped being by Jews, for Jews, with Jews alone. But kind of we moved to the suburbs, we were in the mix. And if you were a non-Jew in a suburban city, you had one golden year where you were going to bar and bat mitzvahs almost every weekend.
I'm going to ask you to go around the table and each take 60 seconds to describe your bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. And if it had a theme, you need to tell us what the theme was.
I'll start.
Okay.
I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and had a bat mitzvah in 1991. And this is the first time ever in public that I'm announcing what my theme was. It was actually a gambling casino theme because my birth date is 7-7-70. Terry, you're laughing. 7-7-77. And so my mother thought, lucky seven. And hired all of my sister's friends to run the casinos. And I think back at that and thought, what the hell were they doing?
What a perfect theme for a spiritual occasion such as, you know, a religious rite of passage, gambling casino. It's perfect.
What can I say? All of the ritual elements of ritual were there, but the casino theme really took the cake.
And Nick, what was your theme?
I was also bar mitzvahed in 1991, and my theme was I had a world theme. So basically, I had flags hanging down from the center in the dance floor and globes on each table, inflatable globes and pocket atlases as the table cards. So you'd come to the front and you'd see Terry Gross and you'd say, open up to page 83. You saw Venezuela. That would be the table you were at. I had a miserable time at my bar mitzvah. For various reasons. I think the main thing was that I was sort of part of, very much involved in the planning process of the party with my mom. And so when I actually got to the party, I didn't begin to relax in any way because I still felt like I was planning the party, worrying about when the pigs in a blanket were coming out. And I think that was my first step into adulthood, which was sort of a sad moment for me.
From which he's never really recovered.
No, that's the truth.
But my bar mitzvah was in Liverpool, and it was in the beginning of the 80s, and Liverpool was a very musical city. Echo and the Bunnymen were huge. The band The Teardrop Explodes were coming through. And 11, 12 years of age, almost every week, I'd say to my mum, could I dye my hair now, please? She'd be like, no. Can I dye my hair now, please? She'd be like, no. So come the bar mitzvah, and you're king for the day. I decided I would have a punk-themed bar mitzvah solely so I could have the opportunity to dye my hair, which I did blue for the occasion. And, I mean, it sounds remarkable. It sounds very punk. But the reality was I had a pair of glasses, which were the same ones as my favorite comedian of the day, Ben Elton, wore he happened to be like a 6'3" gentleman. I was a 5'1" little boy. And if you look in the introduction, I've had everybody phone me up and say, what was your parents thinking that on your bar and bat mitzvah photographs, you were literally wearing a pair of women's spectacles, which is pretty much the case. So I was a young boy pretending to be a man wearing a pair of women's spectacles with blue hat. It was very deep.
And was it punk music only that was played at your bar mitzvah?
I think it was a mix of punk concerts probably across the country. They always throw in a couple of klezmer tunes, and my bar mitzvah was no different.
The music is so key at a bar or bat mitzvah, and whether there's going to be records, you know, or a band. So when you were putting together your book, what did you find was basically in the top 10 of bar mitzvah songs from the period of the 80s and shortly before and after?
The YMCA by the Village People is the most important song to hit the Jewish religion since Havana Villa.
And Madonna Vogue is on here, which leads us to one of my favorite parts of the book, which is Sean Sperling's bar mitzvah, a gentleman from Chicago, and he had a Madonna-themed bar mitzvah, including Madonna airbrushed onto the back of his dress shirt. And there's a picture of him voguing, which he went over and over with his sister beforehand.
Your book is filled with pictures from other people's bar mitzvah albums, the photographs from their albums. And there are obviously a few shots that became like the standard bar mitzvah photo shots. And mm-hmm. Jules, what are some of those posters that everybody seems to have in their album?
Well, I just back up and say that oftentimes these albums came with a note, and the note would say, here are my photographs. There's nothing special here. Use as much as you want. We love the project. And then people would send in albums with awkward teens riding into their bat mitzvah on the back of an elephant. That was Stephanie Huttner from Denver. There was Michelle Shapiro posing at the end of the album in the back of her photographer's Corvette. There was Mike Epstein in front of a mariachi band at his Latino-themed bar mitzvah. So we really got an array of fabulous and wonderful photographs.
And what were some of the standard poses that everybody, no matter what their theme was, seemed to have in their album?
A couple favorites are, of course, there's the wave goodbye, which is at the end of every album. And one of the great things about the wave goodbye picture is about half of the people who sent that picture in said, I think we took this picture about halfway through or the beginning of the evening, the wave goodbye, and, just sort of lending to the the bizarreness of the event. But then seems that a lot of bar mitzvah photographers never met a double exposure that they couldn't and wouldn't fall in love with. And there's a bunch of those. One classic is the boy dreaming, and that with a double exposure of him being kissed on each cheek by two girls.
One of the standard shots I feel like we have to pay homage to here is the shot where the bar mitzvah boy or girl is standing, and there's a portrait of them, but behind them, in this like double exposure, behind them is a silhouette of their profile. So they're standing in a silhouette of their own mm-hmm. profile. And that turns up in everyone's bar mitzvah album, don't you think?
Yes, it's in every, I think there's some great shots of the double exposure, but the double exposure shot is a key. It shows them inside their own head, so to speak. Okay.
You write in the book, the bar mitzvah experience is so much more than a celebration of one young person's passage into adulthood. It's also about the family they were embarrassed to be a part of. And do you feel like you see that embarrassment in some photos, that the kid looks really embarrassed in the kind of setting that they're in?
At that time in general, and these pictures capture that, there's just an awkwardness to life for many people. Some individuals at 13 were literally, and you can see this in the book, they look like they're 22, and good on them. But let's be honest, many of them look like they're about 7 or 8 and are barely out of kindergarten. And in those days, you are dealing with your the feelings you have inside your own mind. You also have the kind of the power of the peer group and how that impacts you. And you're also dealing with your respective crushes. And to throw your family in the mix, having to bring all of these things together, your family, your friends, the people you want to be your friends, the people you wish were in your life. I mean, it was really an emotionally very complicated time for many of the readers to navigate from their comments.
My guests are the authors of the new book, Bar Mitzvah Disco. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are the authors of the new book, Bar Mitzvah Disco, Roger Bennett, Jules Shell, and Nick Kroll. We've been laughing a lot about the Bar Mitzvah themes and the photograph albums and the Village People music that was played there. We haven't talked at all about the religion or the religious significance of the Bar Mitzvah. And I'm wondering if you felt connected to any of that while planning the party or while actually having the party. Did the larger, you know, sense that this is a genuine religious ritual enter much into the equation for you?
Well, I can answer that personally and say I want to know where my Russian twin is. I had a Russian twin named Irina Kislova, and I always wondered what happened to her. And I remember in the announcement that went out in the newspaper that I was being bat mitzvahed, there was some line about me having a Soviet twin and my hope that I would understand that she may come to understand and appreciate her Jewish heritage. And I can't understand. I didn't know if I understood my own Jewish heritage. So to have that responsibility for my Russian twin was quite funny at that age. And I always wonder what happened to her. Where is she now?
So the whole idea of the Russian twin was that you were matched up with a young Jewish girl in the Soviet Union who wasn't allowed to practice her religion?
Correct.
Right. There's a lot of people have that, including Brett Gelman, who's a comedian in New York. And ironically, his theme at his bar mitzvah was Late Night with Brett Gelman, which is the invitation was a big poster of Brett in a tails and a top hat. And it's Late Night with Brett Gelman. And it goes through this whole thing like grandma says he's a class act and things like that. But then at the bottom, this very sort of large, grandiose invitation is at the bottom is Brett Gelman will be sharing his bar mitzvah experience with a Russian boy and an Ethiopian boy. And it's a very interesting paradox of this great level of like, let's celebrate the comedy of Brett Gelman with a very, very austere quote in the bottom about his connection to the Ethiopian Russian boy.
When you were 13 and a lot of your friends were having bar mitzvahs, was there the sense of needing to outdo each other? And were people judged by whether they had a good party or not, whether the party was cool or not? I mean, did it really affect your social status in school?
Well, I will say one of the things that we continue to hear was people saying on both sides of it, either I had a bar mitzvah early in the season, what was called the bar mitzvah season, let's say, like the circuit. And either that was great because you could establish the level of the playing field, or if you ended up at the end of the year, it meant you had even more to overcome because at that point kids had seen everything. So after going to a bunch of Pee Wee Studio 54s, it's tough to overcome that. And you know, it's not the but so there is a level of competition there, I think, at times there was.
But the bar mitzvah also gave the star of the show some real power and some real say and sway socially, even if it was only for one day. And the table shots were a great classic, almost two-thirds of the way through every album, where the bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah kid is sitting with their friends around the table smiling happily. Again, the comments came in that people would say, none of these people were actually my friends. My friends were sitting on table 12. These were the people I longed to be with for the past kind of decade of school. They were the football players, or they were the cool kids, or they were, in some cases, I guess, Dungeons & Dragons players, depending on the kid. But like literally, you were in control, and for that one day, your friends could be whoever you wanted to be. And that seemed to be very much a universal theme.
Thank you all very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks so much, Terry.
Thanks for having us home.
Roger Bennett, Jules Shell, and Nick Kroll are the authors of Bar Mitzvah Disco. You can find pictures from it on our website, freshair.npr.org.